Ready?
Yep. This is the blue lights on.
Good afternoon. Going to start the March. What's today's date?
29th.
Senate Business and Transportation. And we have a senator in the room. Senator Manning, would you please come up? We're going to open it with Senate Bill 10, open a hearing on 1020.
Thank you, sir.
We are adjourned.
That was a joke.
That was a joke.
Maybe we better start it over.
You're going to open the meeting again?
You got that, too, sir.
Nothing.
Well, I'm waiting for you to open the meeting. He just adjourned.
Did we not do that? I thought you had it open. Did you?
I did for one.
It is open, Mr. Chair. Huh? Yes.
I was just kidding.
Oh, you're kidding that you adjourned?
Yeah.
Oh,
I'm
just kidding.
We have opened the meeting.
Have we opened the work session?
Yeah, we've opened the public hearing.
Well, we're there. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Meyer and
first.
Vice Chair Thompson. I really appreciate
your
welcome and members of the committee. My name is James Ivory Manning, Jr. I am the senator for Senate District 7, which is Eugene and Junction City. It's my pleasure to bring to you Senate Bill 1020, which directs ODOT to partner with Lane Transit District in bringing rapid and high-capacity transit to the area. Transit is extremely important means of transportation for our constituents in my district and others in Lane County, and especially vital to low-income residents. We in Eugene have a disproportionate amount of population and job growth, expecting to have more than 20% population growth and 40% job growth over the next 20 years. Currently, some of Eugene's worst traffic bottlenecks are River Road, Coburg Road, and Beltline Highway. Are all in my district, and as bad as it is now, it only stands to get worse. This bill works to address these issues and provide a long-term solution with rapid transit and EMX. And I believe EMX is an important part of helping to improve transportation options for my constituents and will be effective in alleviating traffic congestions for the future. Lane Transit District EMX project has successfully brought more than $100 million in federal investments in our community, and this proposed contribution will ignite a partnership between the City of Eugene and Lane Transit District to match federal funds at a 1-to-1 or even a 2-to-1 rate. This partnership will also create more than 1,000 local jobs, which is really important to me and very necessary in my community, in my district, with more than 60 contractors from the area working on these projects. Today, you will hear from some of my constituents who are here today in support of this bill because they want to see improved transit in our neighborhoods, and I encourage the members of this committee to support this bill as I do. Thank you so much. Subject to any of your questions.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator Manning, if you get this, I'm going to be upset because I've been trying to get light rail out to Forest Grove for 12 years now, and they've ignored me every time. So, but, you know, good luck. I don't know what's going to happen here, but.
So this one's a little cheaper.
No, it actually isn't.
It's not?
No,
okay.
No. This is the cheapest 6 miles in the state. We already have the right-of-way.
Whoa. Okay.
Chair Byers, Senator Riley, if that was a question, I would like to add that I certainly support your project as well. So if you get on board with mine, then I'll come back and help you.
Okay. Riley, a little horse trading.
It's called reciprocity.
Anybody else? Thank you, Senator. We'll let you get back to work.
Thank you.
All right. So let's have the LTD team up here. AJ, Ed. Edward and Carlene? Riley? Are you part of that? I have them bracketed together.
She doesn't work for us, but she rides the bus. So does that count?
Huh?
I said she doesn't work for us, but she rides the bus, so if that counts.
Okay, well, they're...
All right, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Edward McLone with Lane Transit District. I'm really just here for technical reasons. There's a dash one amendment to the bill that should be on the dais with you guys, changing the funding source of the bill from a general fund to a lottery bond appropriation. That was something we wanted to point out. Also wanted to note that something we'll be working with the Ways and Means Committee, should you in your wisdom pass it down to them. It would be a budget note requiring that ODOT not enter into a grant agreement with us unless a federal grant is entered into with LTD as well, to ensure that that match ratio is achieved. So that's what I wanted to say, and I'll pass it off to the rest of the
table. What's the normal match?
The minimum match on a small starts grant is 25% local and 75% federal on a maximum. We're expecting that it would likely be somewhere between, we provide between one-third and up to half of the match, so we would get between two-thirds to half the match at the federal level.
So somewhere between a 2-to-1 and a 3-to-1 match?
That's correct.
Okay.
Pass it on.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Aurora Jackson, most commonly referred to as AJ, and I'm the general manager of Lane Transit District, LTD. I thank you for the opportunity to testify. LTD is a public transit provider for the urbanized area in Lane County, serving Eugene, Springfield, outlying communities, including Junction City, Cottage Grove, and all the way up the McKenzie River Highway to McKenzie Bridge. We provide more than 10 million annual boardings. With fewer than 300 residents in our service area, we rank as one of the top 25 nationally in boardings per capita. Our key ridership demographic includes the U of O students and faculty, Lane Community College, and residents traveling to and from work. More than two-thirds of our trip taken on LTD are for the purpose of getting to and from work and school. LTD is seeking funding for the fourth leg of its bus rapid transit network. We refer to it as MX. For those of you who have not experienced bus rapid transit, it is like traveling on a light rail on wheels at one-tenth the cost of light rail. Bus rapid transit is very flexible in design and allows us to build for the conditions that we have. In areas with less traffic, buses can share the road with motorists. In high congested areas, buses may travel in their own dedicated lane. Other options include buses only having dedicated lanes at traffic lights. We are in a joint study with the City of Eugene to evaluate transportation needs on a system level focused on improving access to jobs, education, housing. We'd like to reduce congestion and greenhouse emissions. And very importantly, we want to address the safety concerns along those key five corridors. Bus rapid transit has been very successful in the 10 years since we began operation of our first corridor. Our system carries more than 25% of annual boardings. It has the lowest cost to operate per passenger and more than $250 million in private investment along the corridor in the last 10 years, including hotels, restaurants, large and small retail development, and more than 700 residential units housing, just to name a few of the improvements that have occurred. Our bus rapid transit system is a key component to our region's transportation plan to manage both population and employment growth. This winter, we will partner with the City of Eugene to select the route for the next corridor. We know that it will serve the busiest arterial in our community. We will apply for federal funding, and we know that we have to have the match secured to be competitive. We intend to submit our grant in the fall of 2018. So that is why we're coming before you today. And we would appreciate your support in attracting new federal dollars to our region. I thank you for your support in advance. And I can answer any questions that you have of me.
So I guess one that I would ask is, can it be a contingent funding? Contingent, I mean, if the legislature that made it up the priority list to be funding, could it be contingent on you getting the federal funding?
Absolutely.
Questions, Senator?
You use double articulated buses on the bus rapid transit, or do you use just standard buses?
We use articulated 60-foot buses on that corridor. We also have the option of using 40-footers, but based on our passenger loads, in order to accommodate a 10-minute frequency, we must use the articulated 60-foot bus.
And those follow up.
Go ahead.
How many passengers will a 60-foot bus hold?
Well, I I won't use my standard. It's as many as we can accommodate on there. But it typically carries a seating load with somewhere like 45 plus standing. When it's a college student or the busiest time of our peak, we can fit somewhere over 100 people on a bus comfortably. We also carry, of course, wheelchair securement areas, and we have bike racks that accommodate that. So that does change the load, but definitely as many as we can accommodate.
And Mr. Chair, the reason I ask is because one driver can carry that many people versus driving one person in one car. Light rail, it's like 1 to 300. One driver handles a light rail load of about of up to 300 people, which is what goes right by my house in Portland.
Yes.
It's a lot more expensive.
I know it's a lot more expensive.
Others? Thank you. Hi.
Thank you. Greetings, Chair Beyer and Business and Transportation Committee members. I'm excited to be here and scared, too. This is the first time I've ever presented in front of a committee.
Oh, you're doing just fine.
Thank you. I'm Carlene Riley, 395 Marion Lane, Eugene, Oregon, and I used to live in Hillsboro, so I would ride that length from there to Forest Grove. I appreciate the opportunity as a 38-year resident of the River Road neighborhood to advocate for Senate Bill 1020. When I refer to we, I am speaking about my experience with several teams of neighbors that I have worked with in the last decade in both the Santa Clara and the River Road neighborhoods. Our newly minted Senator James Manning Jr. is sponsoring this bill, requesting $30 million to help fund the extension of bus rapid transit called MX to both neighborhoods. River Road, the road, has been described as the aorta of our neighborhood, but it might be considered to having congestive heart failure. Safety concerns abound with unsafe pedestrian crossings, backed up traffic, and bus riders in wheelchairs who are left behind because there are no more spaces on the bus. The current Lane Transit District is located at the intersection of Pepe Beltline and River Road. It is a high vehicle crash area, and there is a large high school nearby. Relocation of this transit station to Santa Clara will be helpful as a first step toward the installation of MX, alleviation of traffic congestion, and increased safety. After a decade of advocacy, our neighborhoods are excited about MX's arrival. We don't think that the road would have to be widened in order to accommodate MX, but it would reduce vehicle miles traveled, reduce toxic emissions, and provide safer intersections. We know public transit supports economic development. Neighborhoods excluded from or with inadequate public transit experience decreases in real estate values, businesses and jobs flee, and the broad mix of residents move, making it the low-rent area. Remaining residents would need cars to commute to jobs miles away. We don't want to set our neighborhood up for decimation. Land use applications have multiplied after the economic downturn, with larger tracts of land being developed with three-story apartments and larger residential housing areas. We have two brand new elementary schools to accommodate children from those additional families. We think MX will enhance livability in our neighborhood, make the corridor safer, attract businesses to provide basic goods and services, and transform it to be an amenity that will encourage people who want to walk and ride a bike. Thank you for making the Heart of River Road community regain health and vitality by supporting Senate Bill 1020. I would be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much. The next panel is, it looks like, Bree Nicholson, Eric Gunderson, and Rob Zako. And I would ask, as you come up, we've got a really full agenda today, so if you could try to keep your comments to 3 minutes or less, that would be great. Sorry, I mispronounced your name. Who wants to go first? Eric.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Eric Gunderson, and I live in Eugene, Oregon. I'm also a retired principal at Pivot Architecture, and I want to share with you why I support MX from a business perspective, from the perspective of a business leader. Pivot, our firm made the choice to move to downtown before it was thriving. And one reason that we did that was because of the quality of transit that was available to us in the downtown. MX was located two blocks away, as well as the LTD bus terminal. Our employees care about taking transit, and this made us competitive in attracting talented young workers to our firm. And it just also felt like the right thing to do. So not only does transit make us more competitive as an employer, but MX has made our business more competitive. We were selected to design the stations on LTD's first MX project, which was one of the first BRT corridors in the nation. Our experience with LTD has led us to many more contracts nationwide and positioned our firm to be a national competitor for very desirable work. We're currently working on projects in California, Washington, Utah, and Colorado. When we invest in local transit, we create short-term and long-term jobs. In my time at Pivot, we grew from 3 to 30 people. If not for the opportunities that MX work gave us, we wouldn't be working on transit projects across the country. Your investment will help us pay a long-term dividend to local firms such as Pivot, who will benefit from the learning experience and be able to provide services to other communities, bringing their tax dollars back to Oregon. Thank you very much for the chance to speak.
Thank you, Eric. Please.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Bree Nicolello, and I live and work in Eugene. As of last Friday, I'm a graduate of the University of Oregon, and I also serve on the Eugene Planning Commission and then work as a professional planner for a firm in Eugene, Shermer Satre Group. MX has had a tremendous effect both on my life as a student, but also my decision to live and work in Eugene. As somebody who grew up in a very car-centric community, I've really appreciated the freedom and different choices that MX has afforded me. I get to bike and I get to take transit to work every single day, and it's gotten to the point where my car battery keeps dying. Moreover, many of my clients, and especially those who I see come before Planning Commission, value transportation as a priority. And this is no surprise, because if you've visited Eugene and Springfield recently, torrential rain aside, there is something magnetic happening there. We are in the middle of this beautiful renaissance in Eugene and Springfield, and it is so evident to people who live and work and visit. We're seeing more people move there, but we're also seeing more people stay. We're seeing young people who are deciding to stay in this area and invest in the community that raised them. Couples returning after college and raising their children, drawn by world-class park systems like Willamette Lane and our standout school districts, and other individuals and couples who wish to age in place or move closer to their grandchildren. MX has played an enormous part in this renaissance, opening parts of the region to both new and experienced riders in an easy, equitable, and efficient way. Moreover, as Eric mentioned, MX makes corridors more desirable to developers and businesses relocating to the area. Look no further than Franklin Boulevard in Eugene. You should try Elkhorn Brewery. You should try Planktown in Springfield. These are all places that have become even easier to access because of MX. And MX is not only essential to our economic development goals, but also to ensuring that our region handles population growth and changing demographics in a responsible and sustainable way. Eugene and Springfield, like many other cities in Oregon, are facing a housing crisis, with all levels of income actually struggling to find affordable workforce and market rate units. And as a planner, I can absolutely speak to that. Both Eugene and Springfield have vacancy rates of about 5.5%, which is actually on par with Portland, and I was surprised when I saw that as well. Transportation is an essential part of this equation. Affordable units no longer end up being affordable when someone has to spend a significant part of their monthly budget driving to and from their home. Our region is changing, our population is aging, and new people are moving to Oregon at a rate of 2-to-1. Therefore, our approach to transportation and land use must change as well. And MX is absolutely an essential and wonderful part of that equation. It's an option that allows us to work towards a region that is equitable, affordable, and open for business. So thank you for your time and consideration of this bill, and we look forward to you helping us see our region flourish with your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Rob, I hope this is a short video.
2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for having me. I'm Rob Zako. I'm Executive Director of Better Eugene Springfield Transportation. We're a broad coalition of business, social service, environmental, education, neighborhood, and faith organizations. We support better transportation options, safer streets, and walkable neighborhoods. In particular, BEST supports investing in better transit and supports Senate Bill 1020 for that reason. As you've heard, the Eugene-Springfield area is recognized as a national leader in bus rapid transit, with two lines already in operation and a third scheduled to open West Eugene on September 17th. But I don't want you to listen to me about that. I've brought some friends from North Carolina and have them talk to you about why our system's so great. If I can get this technology to work there and maximize it there and start it there. We've got sound, Nita? Okay.
Yes.
So this is the Chambers of Commerce from the Research Triangle area of North Carolina want bus rapid transit there, and they don't have it. We do, and so they came out to Eugene in Seattle, talked to a bunch of people, and made this video, and I'm going to show you just a couple excerpts out of this.
Joe. We live in a growing, thriving community. Just look at what's occurred on Fayetteville Street in just a few years. We need to have that same accelerated vision for transit. I understand that bus rapid transit is becoming a best practice in some of the fastest growing markets in the United States. Those regions are bringing innovative, scalable transit solutions to the market quickly. But most of us don't have a real knowledge of bus rapid transit.
Tom, you're exactly right. Eugene and Seattle are two progressive, fast-growing metro areas with a high-tech economy that are implementing various elements of bus rapid transit. Those elements would...
Okay, let me try to fast forward here to about there.
A catalyst for the land use change and the redevelopment of the area.
I can tell you from firsthand experience, the developers I talk to are very excited about the immediacy and the availability of the bus rapid transit system, because they're not thinking in terms of what their development will be like in 15 years. They're having to make their pro forma work in the next 3 years.
Bus rapid transit can certainly have economic development benefits, very similar to light rail if it's done correctly. And it's, to a certain extent, it's about the level of permanence.
We're the ones that are doing the permanent infrastructure development by providing the pedestrian amenities. The BRT will never go anywhere else after what we've done.
I can't imagine this facility working as well as it does without bus rapid transit.
What you end up with is a development opportunity that doesn't look like circles, it looks like a corridor, and that is exactly what we had in Shoreline.
I think going big is one of the key ingredients. Don't just do one line and put all your eggs in that one basket. Make sure that you've got more of a network approach.
So one of the things that makes bus rapid transit so attractive is that it's taking a limited amount of money and maximizing the number of links of the system that gets created.
This is the system for today, this is the system for tomorrow, this is the system for the far-reaching future that we envision for this community.
The main story.
Joe, I was really impressed with the innovations we saw in the bus systems in both Eugene and Seattle. I think several of these could align with the goals and values of our community.
Tom, I agree. The innovations that we saw could create a lot of benefits for us, focusing economic development included. But one of the main benefits would be freedom for all the members of our community. Freedom from congestion, freedom from transit schedules, and freedom from having to worry about driving or parking. Joe, you know what? I think it's time.
And that link apparently is available if you want to watch all of it. So let me just sort of spell this out for you. North Carolina wants bus rapid transit. In order for Oregon to get bus rapid transit, we need the help of the state to invest in that. The situation is that Lane Transit District, working with Cities of Eugene and Springfield and the community, are assessing the likelihood or the feasibility of different corridors. River Road is one you've heard about. We'll be making a decision this fall or winter. And because of the timing, it's important to have a state match in order to be able to compete successfully for federal transportation dollars. My organization supports this. We think it's going to be great for economic development for the community. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks very much. And I have one more person signed up, Mark Connect.
Here we go.
Welcome.
Well, thank you. My name's Mark Knack, and I live here in Marion County, but we need something like that here in Marion County, too. And I'm surprised the some people from the transit district, the Kaiser Transit, aren't here today, but I support this bill because we do need transit south of here too. And I was just, we had the train hearing yesterday, and I was just curious as to how far, I know they've been working on trying to get the light rail or the commuter train as far south as Medford to the California border, but that hasn't happened. But that's trains, but that's not buses. But we need something like that here in Marion County and other counties in the state too. And I just thought I'd mention that.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate that. That's all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to comment on Senate Bill 1020? Seeing none, I believe we have the paperwork, so we'll close public hearing, open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1020.
Senator Thompson has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1020. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? The motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 1020 with the Dash 1 amendment to the floor, or with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 1020 as amended by the Dash Ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to that motion? There is none. And so we will close on that, and we'll note that that takes it down to Ways and Means and puts you in line with a bunch of other stuff, and you'll have to argue with Senator Girard down there. All righty. So we will close, if I haven't, on Senate Bill 1020. Did we do this one already?
You need to do this one.
Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 974. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 974 prohibits persons other than retail customers of vehicle dealers from making a claim against a vehicle dealer under certain circumstances. We have a Dash 1 amendment, which I will not dispense with reading so we can get to the testimony list. With the Dash 1 amendment, the measure has minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. And Fuller is here, I believe, is who's going to come up.
Mr. Fuller.
First, yes.
Thank you. Oh, there we go. There's my list.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association. We requested the original bill and the Dash 1 amendments. We appreciate committee staff assistance in getting the bill done. I'm going to tell you a little bit about why we had the bill introduced, what the bill's intended to do, and then I'm going to ask you not to go to work session because some of the people that follow me are going to tell you that the amendments to the bill do exactly the opposite of what legislative counsel and the Department of Justice told us they did. And so we need to get the attorneys who say one thing and the attorneys who say the other thing together to make sure that the amendments do what we intend to do. And so I apologize for that. But let me tell you what the bill is supposed to do based on the request that we made. Currently, to be a motor vehicle dealer, you have to have a $40,000 bond. When I started lobbying in 1996, it was a $15,000 bond. So we're slowly increasing the value of that bond. That bond is designed to protect people who don't get their title or registration completed by the dealer because the dealer has a failure or something has happened and the dealer doesn't have the money to complete the transactions. So that's the purpose of the bond. This bill increases the bond from $40,000 to $50,000, so it's an incremental move forward. In addition, we learned over time that dealers and financial institutions often knew that a dealer failed before consumers did, and so financial institutions and other dealers would get in line and exhaust the bond before consumers actually knew what was going on, realized they had been ripped off, and by the time they got in line and understood the process of filing against the bond, there wasn't anything left. So we began a process of restricting access by dealers and financial institutions and other businesses to the bond, giving the bond, most of the bond, to consumer-only protection. So currently, $20,000 of the bond is available only to consumers, and then $20,000 of the bond is available to either consumers or lending institutions and dealers and other businesses. We restrict business access to the bond in the bill from $20,000 down to $10,000. At least that's the intent. Some of the witnesses who follow me will tell you that the language that has been written doesn't do that, and we want to make sure that it's clear that the language does what we intend it to do. So by increasing the bond from $40,000 to $50,000 and reducing business access to the bond from $20,000 down to $10,000, you end up with a doubling of consumer access to the bond from $20,000 to $40,000. So consumers have significantly more money that's accessible to them through the bond. In addition to that, we are in the process of creating reciprocity between Oregon dealers and out-of-state dealers. Right now, there are some other states that have consumer-only bonds, which means a dealer in Oregon, if they get ripped off by an out-of-state dealer, we can't file against their bond. And that's fine, but we believe that if an Oregon dealer can't file against a bond in another state, that dealers from that state shouldn't be able to file against our bond. Why should we give them access to our bond if we don't have access to theirs? So there's a restriction in the bill that out-of-state dealers can't access our bond unless dealers in our state have access to theirs.
Let's not spend too much time on this now. If you're going to have an amendment, we're going to bring it back.
That's right.
Anyway.
Just one more point, and then I'm done.
Okay.
And that is that there is a rarely used motorcycle-only dealer's license that we're starting to phase out. It has only a $2,000 bond. We're increasing it to $10,000. All of those existing motorcycle-only dealer licenses will remain in effect, but it restricts DMV from issuing any additional dealer license bonds for motorcycles only. That's the intent of the bill, and we're going to work with people that don't think it does what we think it says.
Okay. Well,
happy to answer any questions.
Sounds like we're going to see this again after you get the thing worked out. So thank you very much. I have Gary Sargent and Young Wajikin. Kim? I think that's a name. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that.
No problem. Go ahead. Oh, I'm going first. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Young Walgen Kim. I'm a private attorney in Salem. I represent consumers against car dealers. My concern with this bill is I understand what their intent is, but the bill doesn't really say that. Number one, the intent is to restrict access, commercial access, to the bond from $20,000 to $10,000 per year. But if you look at the language, it actually what it does is it increases access. So according to what the language says, each commercial claimant can tap up to $10,000 per claim.
So you're going to fix it, right? You're going to work with Mr. Fuller and fix it? Is that the idea?
His testimony, that was the first time I heard of it. And if he is open to my suggestions, I would like to work with him to get that fixed. Another concern with the language, if you're interested in hearing that part of it, is the restriction that he wants to, that they want to include on here is for out-of-state claimants to have a bond in order to make the claim onto Oregon's bond. But what it does is it allows lenders and auction houses and flooring companies, the people who are not dealers and they don't have bonds, to access the full value of that bond. So the language as is written doesn't actually do what the OVDA intended it to do, and that's another issue that we would like to handle with Mr. Fuller. Now, one thing I do want to mention is that there is another bill, HB 3323, that is attempting to increase the bond from $40,000 to $100,000. And that is because right now $40,000, even $50,000 is not enough. I don't know if you've seen read the articles on Northwest RV and Jones 5. On those cases, these dealers, especially on Northwest RV, they took consignments on RVs, sold these cars or these RVs on consignment, and they just took the money. They didn't pay the consigners, and they didn't deliver title. Each one of these transactions, the RVs cost $50,000 plus. And so the bond only gives you $40,000, $50,000 per year for all the claimants. For Northwest RV, we have $500,000 worth of claims for a $40,000 bond. The bond is not adequate, and although we support an increase, we would like to see more than a $10,000 increase.
Well, I'll let you try and work that out. Sounds like there's a willingness to do that. And
thank you, Chair Beyer.
Chair Beyer, Senators, my name is Gary Sargent. I'm Chairman of the Board of the Oregon Independent Automobile Dealers Association. The association is not only recognized by the National Independent Automobile Dealers Association, but has been in Oregon since 1948. The problem, this is the first time we've heard that Mr. Fuller is willing to work with us in regards to our concerns, and our concerns are that last legislature, it was allowed for the flooring companies to have access to the bond. They didn't have access to that bond. And so what we've seen now is from insurance agents that have confided in me, we've seen an increase in bonding companies not wanting to write bonds for Oregon dealers because of the risk that and access that these flooring companies have. So it's concerning to increase the bond. We're at a double-edged sword, and where the double-edged sword comes in is the business regulations that regulates the dealer body. Their budget is set by the number of dealers in business. So in raising the bond from $40,000 to $50,000 to $100,000 may put many dealers out of business because they don't have the credit credentials to reach that $100,000 bond or even a $500,000 bond. So that's one concern. The second concern that we have is the minimizing the access, and it's strictly, absolutely discriminative, minimizing the access that a business owner would have in filing against the bond. They should have an equal. There's no difference between a consumer or a business. They've made both the consumer and the business owner have made the conscious decision to do business with a dealer, and irregardless of who they are. So restricting a business owner to only $10,000 worth of access and from the $20,000 is very discriminative. Lastly, the bond that has been in effect for a motorcycle dealer has been $2,000 forever. The increase to $10,000 is not a large enough increase. It should be $20,000. The last Harley-Davidson that I bought was $29,000 for one vehicle. So, and that's not a scale to balance the bond on, but it is concerning that we've only had a $2,000 bond. I've been in business for 43 years here in Oregon and a fourth-generation business. And $40,000 is a palatable bond level. Increasing it may give the bonding companies another bullet to not do business in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that if it is a restriction or a requirement of our being able to be in business is that we have to be bondable. So if bonding companies disappear and they say that Oregon's bonds are too expensive or we don't have people qualifying for it, so it's not a lucrative business for them, they won't write bonds in Oregon. And that has happened in other states. And the $40,000 bond is right on par with other states in our 50 states. Thank you.
Okay. Well, it sounds like there's a lot of complicating and competing issues, and I think we'll let you gentlemen see if you can work that out. Is there anybody else who feels the need to testify on this bill? All righty. So we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 974, and we're going to move to... We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 980. Oh, and then we'll go back.
Let's see, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 980 requires motor vehicle manufacturers, distributors, and importers to reimburse dealers for service-related vehicle recall at the same rate as warranty work. Provides for a compensation equal to 2.43% of the vehicle's value per month of the dealer in circumstances where a dealer is prohibited by a manufacturer from selling or driving a vehicle subject to the recall and does not have either a remedy to the defect that led to the recall or parts to remedy the defect. Prohibits a manufacturer, importer, distributor for recovering cost of a dealer's claim for service in connection with vehicle recall by reducing payments from an incentive program or removing the dealer from an incentive program. It also specifies the dealer must disclose in writing the person that a purchaser who purchases a used motor vehicle of all manufacturer recalls to which the vehicle remains subject for defects that do not be remedied. Mr. Chair, we also have in our hand the Dash 1 Amendment. Reduces the amount of compensation to dealer under prohibition from 2.43% of vehicle value to 1.75% of vehicle value and specifies that compensation is to commence 15 days after the prohibition is issued. With the Dash 1 Amendment, Mr. Chair, this measure has no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
All righty. Mr. Perry. And do you want to bring the others up with you? Yep.
Great.
Welcome.
Chair Byers, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry, the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Thanks for hearing this today. I'll let some of the real people talk a little bit longer, but I just wanted to touch base on what Patrick said about the amendments. There are obviously two manufacturer groups. One of them signed up to testify after us, but the other one is the global manufacturers, and they have a piece of paper in the file that talks about they wanted a couple of changes to this bill to be done, which is what the Dash 1 amendments accomplishes. So one of the next speakers is going to talk about a J.D. Power study in his presentation, but what the J.D. Power study does is it talks about the cost in certain portions of this to the dealer being 2.43%, which is what the bill said. The global manufacturers ask that we lower that to 0.175, which is what the amendment does. It also gives a 15-day grace period so they can fix that recall issue within 15 days for no cost. That 1.75% then only kicks in after the 15 days. The last portion of the amendment, which one of the speakers in the next panel will talk about if they get called up in that order, is the DOJ addressed that the issue on the safety recall postings through rules, and he will kind of walk through that process. So what we're hoping, the testimony coming forward is going to be talking about the bill with the Dash 1 amendments included, because that's what we had worked with the other manufacturers on. So after the next two testifiers, I'd be happy to answer any questions if you'd like.
To be clear, the Dash 1 amendment is your amendment to your original bill.
Okay. And it deals with a letter from the global manufacturers on the record.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Byers, members of the committee, my name is Tim Ernest. I'm the OADA.
You can back off a little bit of the mic.
The OADA president. And here asking your support of Senate Bill 980. This bill provides dealers a reasonable assessment of the expenses and the collateral value loss resulting from actions or directives that require dealers to ground a vehicle pending a recall completion. The drivers of these costs are interest on the money, depreciation of the asset, and the storage costs, as well as insurance. J.D. Power did a paper on the costs associated with stop sales, and their estimates have ranged from a high of 3.46% to a low of 1.4. I feel that the 1.75 that we are asking is a fair rate to fairly distribute the cost incurred by dealers for no-sale actions. You have any questions?
No, we're talking about used vehicles here?
Correct.
Okay. Things you've taken in a trade-in or purchased at auto auction?
Exactly.
Well, they could be new or used, right?
They could be new or used.
It's a used bill.
But this bill right here does concern just used.
The question, we're talking monthly percentages, so like 1.75 would be 21% annually, is that correct?
No, I think that's the annual cost on that would be the Well, no, that is a monthly percent.
Yeah, they actually, one of the next speakers will talk about how they prorate it, too. So I asked him specifically to address that because I figured it'd come up as a question.
Okay. Any others? Oh, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Byers and Senators, for speaking with us today. I'm Bob Lanfear, Jr., Lanfear Enterprises, and I'm past president of Oregon Auto Dealers Association. And I'm here to speak on the behalf that we're just simply asking the manufacturers to pay their fair share of grounding these vehicles on items that they have grounded the cars for. It's not the dealer's fault. These cars come back to us. We have to sit on these cars 7, 8, 9 months sometimes to get parts for these cars. The cost of the hidden cost of the fuel in the carburetors because of the ethanol fuel, the batteries, the detail. Customers, when they come back to pick up their cars, have got to run. They've sat for a long time. You've got to make them run. The costs are hidden and not very they cover the cost of the repair, and parts and labor, but they don't do anything else to help us with the storage cost and the repair cost to repair the car other than what they did in the recall. So thank you so much for your support.
And Bill, did you have an answer to the question that the senator asked and drew out about? Is it what's the annualized versus the monthly cost?
Well, that's what I think one of the chair buyer members of the committee, one of the previous speakers, I've asked him to talk about the ratio of the percentage and the recall, which is the removal of Section 2 of this bill on page 4. So I'm hoping that he should be able, and if he doesn't, we can get an answer.
Okay,
to that question.
We'll go ahead and try. Any other questions to Senator Monroe? Yeah.
Okay, we're talking about a car where there's a recall, and it's sitting at the repair, the dealer, like Beaverton Infinity, for example, in my case. Can't the company simply give the customer a loaner during the time when he's waiting for the parts and so on?
You want to go through your example?
Well, we can. There's a cost involved, and sometimes the manufacturer covers some of those costs. There's a lot of hidden cost in putting a customer into a brand new car to drive while you're waiting for the car parts to arrive. Let's say, for an example, some of the airbags that we had to wait for, the airbag issue. You put someone in a car for 7 months. What does that do to the value of that car and the miles they put on that car and the depreciation of that car? The manufacturer doesn't participate at all on that.
Yeah, your company only had to give me a loaner for about 5 days, I think it was once.
Perfect.
Okay. Any others? Thank you very much. We'll then go to Jolene Thompson and Craig Nichols. Perhaps we'll get the answer to your question now.
Well, 17.5 times 12 is 21.
Welcome.
Okay. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share a dealership perspective on Senate Bill 980. To give recent real examples of why this legislation is needed, Chevrolet Silverado trucks are Guarantee Chevrolet's number one selling vehicle.
What's your name?
Jolene Thompson, T-H-O-M-S-O-N, with Guarantee Chevrolet. Our number one selling vehicle currently is the Chevrolet Silverado. When the Takata airbag recall was issued, Guarantee had $200,000 worth of inventory tied up for approximately 8 months. At roughly the same time, GM also issued a stop sell recall on many Chevrolet SUVs due to a defect in a windshield wiper motor. A large inventory with the inability to sell it is incredibly costly for a dealership. Currently, there is no recompense for dealers when their inventory is put on stop sell, and there's no mechanism to put pressure on manufacturers to move quickly to provide parts for the repairs. At their leisure, in the method most beneficial to their interests, they can provide dealerships with the parts to complete the repairs. Until that time comes, dealers are losing precious real estate to display product that can be sold. However, this pales in comparison to where money really gets lost. Currently, Kelley Blue Book adjusts values weekly due to the market's volatility. Over the course of the months mentioned, we, as well as others, have lost millions in both sales revenue and lost asset value. And this bill would provide a small measure of relief when that occurs. And thank you for giving this your consideration.
Chair Byers, members of the committee, my name is Craig Nichols. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. And I've been given very specific instructions, and I'll just take a minute here to explain that there is a Section 2 to this bill that requires the disclosure of recalls and requires that to be the disclosure to be given to the consumer. Well, the Department of Justice has already taken care of that, and they've done that by rule. It's OAR 137-020-0020, Section 3, Part 0, where they say that the disclosure of material nonconformities and defects prior to the sale or lease of a motor vehicle, a dealer or broker shall disclose existing material nonconformities and defects about which the dealer or broker should have known or negligently disregarded when the dealer or broker should have known. This includes, but is not limited to, if repairs have been performed pursuant to a safety recall and needed repairs can be identified through a VIN search. And what they're referring to is NHTSA, the National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration, has a database that the dealers can go on and can find out by VIN number if the car is subject to a safety recall. We at OADA have created a form for our dealers to use, and they're using it statewide because for us to ignore this rule is a violation of the UTPA, the Unlawful Trade Practice Act, which this rule is incorporated into. Now, there was a question, I think it was Senator Riley or Senator Girard, that had a question about the annualized percentage. Yes, if you take 1.75 times 12, it's going to equal 21%. But I think that there's not a manufacturer in the country that wants to let those recalled cars sit for 12 months. And our dealers certainly don't want to let them sit for 12 months. So the problem here is that millions of cars have been affected by the Takata airbag recall. And our dealers are really taking a beating on the used cars. Now, there is a remedy, a federal remedy, for new cars, but there's no protection on used cars, and that's what this bill is about.
So let me ask you about that. My understanding, or someone has said, and I don't know if it's accurate or not, that for new cars, the national agreement is 1% interest rate?
That's correct.
So why would we have a higher one for used cars?
It's based on the cost to the dealers, and there's been studies on that, and the costs actually are much higher than the 1.75.
So why is it higher for a new car or used car than a...
I think that's just what they negotiated years and years ago. That federal statute has been in place for a number of years also. So, and...
So what I'm hearing you say is the difference is that's just what they negotiated and doesn't necessarily reflect cost.
That's correct.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Other questions?
Thank you.
Don't see any. Thank you very much. All righty. Paul Cosgrove and Kurt Lawrence.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. And I know your time is short, so I'll be reasonably brief. I would just like to point out that a couple of things, one of which was just mentioned. This is a bill that only deals with used cars, and the new car issue has been settled in federal law, so we're not dealing with new cars, which means this isn't anything to do with VW diesel recalls or any of the new car recalls that have occurred that you've read about in the media. Secondly, the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, as Mr. Kurt Augustine will mention, represents most of the car dealers in the world, 70% of the American market, and they have significant concerns regarding a number of provisions of the bill. He'll highlight those, but I think the bottom line is there's a lot of work left to do to make this a reasonable and acceptable bill. We have offered a model that has been passed in four other states and is pending in several others that provides provides a 1% reimbursement. That's the same as federal law that would start after 30 days. We are still willing to provide for that. It also has some changes in the actual language of how that is calculated. For example, the current bill says whatever percentage is agreed to by the legislation, you pay that for each month or part thereof. So if a one-day delay, that's a one-month, 1% charge, and we think that should be prorated. There are a number of changes like that that would need to be made, but we are willing to propose a solution that is consistent with the federal for new cars and provide some reimbursement to the dealer. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Augustine, if I may.
Thank you.
Senator and members, my name is Kurt Augustine. I'm with the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, made up of 12 manufacturers that represents approximately 70% of the vehicles sold in the United States. And I want to make it very clear that manufacturers take recalls very seriously, and we fully compensate our customers and the dealers on all recall work. There's been discussions about some of the negotiations, and the auto manufacturers tried to find an agreeable solution with the dealers at the national level on this issue, and we reached agreement on most of the language, but not on the reimbursement rate. The Alliance suspended our discussions with the National Dealers Association because there were no actual legislative bills in file, and on the advice of our counsel, we were at risk of violating federal antitrust laws, and we suspended our talks until there were actually bills introduced. As such, we have been speaking to state organizations throughout the country. So while the national issue the national talks did not bring resolution, we have successfully reached agreement with several state dealer organizations on both the compensation levels and the operating language of that compensation. However, SB 980 is quite divergent on all these issues. You've also heard testimony about a letter that is submitted on file of the global automakers. And while the compensation rate that the new amendment does reflect that, it does not reflect the language of how all these operational issues are going to be. So this bill is not any part of any national deal. It's not part of any agreement, and we have at least four major points that this bill does not even reflect the deal made with the other organization. The Alliance has offered to discuss a compromise bill, but we've been rebuffed here in Oregon on those issues. We believe that our offer of 1% annually, which is 1% per month, 12% annually, it is the federal law, and it's the same rate that we provide dealers on new cars, and we believe it's very reasonable. There was a question about how the 1% came about. It is federal law that was passed in the 70s, and if you recall from the era of the 70s, interest rates were a lot higher than they are now. If the 1% was a fair value then, it is more than fair now. The 1% that we have offered matches what has been enacted into law in both Maryland and Virginia last year, and two other state dealer associations, Alabama and Georgia, have agreed to that this year, and other states are prepared to enter legislation with those numbers. Additionally, earlier this year, the Utah State Legislature failed to pass a similar bill to 980 because they felt that it was an overreach and should not be passed under those levels. So although the 1.75 sounds like a small number, it is 21%. You'd be legislating a mandate of five times the prime rate. But probably more important than that, there's no business case or financial analysis to defend the 1.5%. And in fact, in a recent legislative hearing in Arizona, the lawyer who represents the dealer association said it was simply a number in between what the dealer's original offer was and what was an original offer by the other manufacturing association. You've heard some mention about this J.D. Power survey. That original number of 2.43 that was just amended out came from this study, which has been discredited even to the point that the J.D. Power Company is redoing the survey. And it's important to note it was a survey. It's not a study. It was a survey of members of auto dealers who chose to respond. Again, not a study, a survey. Again, the numbers have been so disputed that J.D. Power themselves said they will redo this, the survey. But what is equally important, and probably the most important thing, that if this bill was passed today, it does not fix a single car that's going to be recalled. It does not help consumers, nor does it make our roads safer. So in addition, with these significant misgivings, there are other issues with the bill language that we need to discuss. The bill does not provide an adequate time period for reimbursement. The amendments did change it to 15 days. However, this time period has not been agreed to in other states, and it's also, its purpose is to offset the time that the dealer recalls to try to fix the vehicle. Our data indicates anywhere from 45 to 60 days is the average time a vehicle sits on the lot. So to start being compensated at 15 days, we believe, is unfair. And the dealer groups in other states have agreed to time frames between 30 and 45 days. The prorated provision that has been discussed, I won't belabor that, but it essentially says one day, if it's even just one day into that month, we have to pay the whole month. Now, on Section 650.158.3CA, we have an issue. Now, while the language in Section BA properly characterizes the recall scope as compensation for manufacturer stop sale and when the parts are available, in Section 3CA, it says or available. So the bill is in conflict with each other, and that needs to be rectified as it has been in other states. Also, those particular sections change the way for the basis for the calculating the compensation off the retail value of the car. So if a car is 3 years old,
section three, section.
They want this 21% compensation to be on the value of the new car. Mm-hmm. How is that fair that we are to pay a reimbursement rate on an older vehicle when dealers do not have a used vehicle in their accounting at full retail value? They didn't acquire that vehicle at full retail value, and they don't have that vehicle retail financed at that retail rate. Therefore, we believe that is a big overreach, and we think that a fair way to determine compensation for having the delay of the sale is to use the average trade-in value, which has been agreed to in every state I've discussed. In addition, there are other states. There are no way in the audit language that we can verify all this. There are clear prohibitions on what we can look into. We just have to accept these claims. We don't believe that's fair. In addition, there are other issues. The bill contains no clear end date to when this compensation requirement should end. It kind of creates a perverse disincentive to actually repair the vehicle. The bill contains no language specifying the type of used vehicle when that can be compensated. We believe that if a dealer accepts a vehicle for trade-in, he should be compensated. But if he goes and buys a car at wholesale and puts it on his lot, that's a business decision he made, and we should not be compensated, having to compensate him for that. There's also no language for maximum compensation. So if these extended recalls go on, which unfortunately they have had, and that does no one any good, but under this formula that's in the bill right now, we would compensate potentially a dealer for greater than the value of the car. We don't believe that that's fair. We also think that there is language that should recognize that many manufacturers have currently initiated compensation programs with dealers prior to these bills. This law bill would prohibit those type of offers, and we believe that that should be included. And I'll wrap up saying that safety is the highest priority for the manufacturers. Yet this bill does nothing to enhance safety. However, we have an offer on the table that has been accepted by dealers in four states. We could resolve the issues that are raised in this bill today if the Oregon dealers joined with their brethren in these other states to solve this problem. The Alliance asks that you amend this bill so that we can resolve this issue in an agreeable manner as soon as possible. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
So have you proposed an amendment?
We have discussed it, Your Honor. Your Honorable Mr. Chairman. We have discussed it with folks. We're waiting to see what the Dealer Association amendment would be. We just saw that today. I hadn't seen it before. So, no, we have not submitted an amendment. We were happy to do so. And if you authorize it, I'll work with committee staff and get one in the works. It should be relatively simple to do.
So how many states do you have agreements resolve this issue in now?
Currently four, and with several other states are pending.
Questions? Don't see any. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? We do not have paperwork today. So we do not have paperwork to work this bill today, and it sounds like there's some room for maybe some more discussion. So there's clearly something that I think needs to be resolved here. It's just a matter of whether you can come to some agreement or not, or you want to let us pick one or the other. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 980, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 981. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 981 outlines vehicle requirements for automated motor vehicles. It establishes procedures by which automated motor vehicle manufacturers submit certificates of compliance to the Department of Transportation and permits the operation of an on-demand automated motor vehicle network. We do not have an amendment in hand for this, Mr. Chair, and also currently lack the fiscal and revenue impact statements on the measure, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And let's see who we're going to start out with here. Who's the sponsor? General Motors, Harry Lightsey? Not sure I'm saying
that's
right.
I believe that's correct.
Is that right?
Yes, it is.
Wasn't sure if that was a T or an S.
Apologize for my bad handwriting, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Beyer, and members of the committee. My name is Harry Lightsey, and I am the Executive Director of Emerging Technologies Policy at General Motors. Self-driving cars have the potential to offer many benefits to our society. They provide an option for those who cannot or choose not to own or operate a vehicle. Self-driving vehicles will make it easier for people who do not have access to mass transit, and they'll open up new economic options by expanding American mobility. While self-driving cars bring many benefits, the most important benefit we see and stress is safety. Nationwide, almost 40,000 people died on our roads and highways in 2016 due to car crashes, and well over 90% of those deaths are caused by human error. Self-driving vehicles will save lives. However, without changes to state law, it is not possible to make progress on self-driving vehicles in Oregon. Current laws clearly contemplate a human driver in the vehicle, making it impossible to test and deploy these vehicles here, and that is why action is needed. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman Beyer, let me say that General Motors supports a fully competitive and open market for development and testing and deployment of self-driving vehicles. We do not support provisions of any law that would restrict the types of companies that could develop and test and deploy these vehicles. We do believe that any company that tests and deploys these vehicles should have safety as their top priority, and we do believe that they should be accountable for the safety of the motoring public, for the safe performance of their products. And we support reasonable provisions around those terms. Just briefly, running through Senate Bill 981, the first substantive section, which is Section 2, has a series of definitions, which are industry standard definitions in this area that have been developed under the auspices of the SAE. Section 3 has a very critical provision at the beginning of it that clearly authorizes a manufacturer to place an automated motor vehicle on the highways of the state. There are certain requirements with regard to what requirements a manufacturer might have to meet in order to do that. We have heard from other stakeholders that they consider these requirements to be significant hurdles and that they should be lowered. Frankly, we're willing to discuss that. As I indicated, General Motors has no desire to unnecessarily keep any innovative company from being able to test and develop these vehicles. Section 4 has some vehicle requirements itself, and once again, we believe that these are safety requirements, but we are willing to discuss any of these that anyone would consider a barrier to being able to test and deploy these types of vehicles. Section 5 has provisions in it about determining where the vehicles might operate within a community. At General Motors, we envision that the early deployments of these vehicles will be in bounded territories within communities. However, we've also heard from other stakeholders that they believe that this provision is unnecessarily restrictive, that there are other business models that they would like to pursue, and so we're certainly willing to discuss those provisions as well. As similarly with Section 6 data collection and Section 7, which authorizes the operation of an on-demand motor vehicle network using self-driving vehicles. Once again, we believe that operation of an on-demand network is a great way to introduce the public to these vehicles because it allows them to simply use the vehicle to get from point A to point B instead of having to consider a significant purchasing decision. Section 8 is very important because it basically establishes that the automated driving system in the vehicle, the computer system that drives the vehicle, meets all of the requirements in Oregon law that would apply to a human driver. And so that is necessary in order to make it clear that these types of vehicles are operable on the roads and highways. Section 9 deals with liability, and I know we've heard from other stakeholders that they have concerns about this provision. It simply says that if a manufacturer puts a vehicle on the road and that vehicle is modified without the consent of the manufacturer at some point in time, that the manufacturer should not be held liable for that modification that's made by a third party without their consent. The rest of the bill, frankly, are sections of the Oregon law that clearly contemplate that there's a person behind the wheel of the vehicle, and there are conforming changes which make it clear that a self-driving vehicle, which is being driven by a computer system, meets those requirements or is exempted from those requirements. There's one more section that is substantive that I'd like to draw your attention to. That's Section 15, local preemption. That section is in here to ensure that a patchwork of local requirements wouldn't be built up where it would be difficult to for the vehicles to move from one community to another. However, we certainly heard from other stakeholders, and I think we may hear from stakeholders later today that indicate they have concerns about that provision as well, and we are willing to discuss that provision and work with the communities in the state of Oregon to determine whether that is appropriate in Oregon or not.
So is GM's primary interest here is being able to pilot and test? Are you talking about being able to start selling and people individually using them?
So Chairman Beyer, what we see is happening, and this technology is developing very rapidly. Today, General Motors has a test fleet of over 50 of these vehicles that are driving on the public roads and streets in the city of San Francisco, in Scottsdale, Arizona, and in the Metro Detroit region. And so every day these vehicles are out on the streets, They're learning how to negotiate through traffic and how to deal with the situations that they encounter on the streets, and they're getting to be better and better. And so the technology is progressing very rapidly. Today, as we are testing, we have a person behind the wheel of the vehicle. We call those the AV trainers, and they're prepared, fully prepared to take control of the vehicle if the vehicle encounters a situation that it can't handle itself.
So is that exactly the same kind of thing you're considering wanting to do in Oregon?
So, Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, thank you. What we would like to do is see a path to full deployment of the vehicles. And as we've said, we envision that the early rollout of these vehicles will be within defined areas in communities and in ride-sharing applications where the manufacturer can control the fleet, make sure the software is up to date, make sure that the vehicles and the sensor systems are all properly maintained. And that way, we can ensure the safe performance of the vehicles.
Don't you think it'd be better to have a national standard rather than 50 or more separate ones?
Well, we certainly think that a national standard is something that could be aspired to. However, we also understand that under our system of government, you know, the states play traditionally a very important role, and the federal government plays a very important role. In late 2016, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, issued its federal automated vehicle policy guidance. And in that guidance, it clearly said that it believed that states had a very important role to play in encouraging the development of this technology. And it encouraged states to look at their laws to remove roadblocks in order to facilitate the safe and rapid development of the technology, because everyone sees the potential here to save a tremendous amount of lives. And so that is what we think this bill does. It is following directly what the NHTSA encourages the states to do, and that's why we support it.
Thank you. Question, Senator Riley?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I can see how this would be a reasonable thing as long as we had things like the rideshare, those kind of organizations that are going to keep all the software up to date. It concerns me a bit when we are to the point where we're going to turn this over to individuals who, as we all know, don't update our software on our computers and our phones and the like at any time, frankly. We know what happens when systems don't get updated, and the company that creates the software says, oh, we no longer maintain that because it's old and you shouldn't be having it anyway, but everybody still has it. So what's the answer to that?
So thank you so much, Chairman Beyer and Senator Riley. So we believe that where we are today is a very critical time in the development of this technology. And what we know from talking to the public about the concept of self-driving vehicles is, I think everybody understands what I said at the very beginning, that there is a tremendous opportunity here to save thousands and thousands of lives, because we know, frankly, that human beings are not very good drivers. They get distracted when they're behind the wheel. They drive when they're impaired or when they're not capable of performing the driving task very well. Computer systems will not have any of those problems, and that's why we all understand that there's a tremendous opportunity here for safety. But when you go talk to the public and you say, are you ready to get into a car that's being driven by a computer system and there's no person behind the wheel, we get a very clear response that the people are not ready to take that step yet. And so I think we all have to do a very important job of introducing the technology to the public in a way that provides them with the assurance that they can use this technology and these vehicles will get them from point A to point B in a safe and reliable way. And I think it's incumbent on the manufacturers to assume that responsibility to reassure the public and to reassure policymakers that our products are going to be safe and reliable. And indeed, our entire reputation stands on that. At General Motors, we are and have publicly said that we will not take any step along this path toward the deployment of self-driving vehicles until we are fully confident we have the data to support that we can take that step in a safe way that protects the public.
So first, let me say that there are Ford people and there are Chevy people. I'm a Chevy guy, so don't take this
personally.
Thank you
personally. Very much. We appreciate that.
But I'm also the chair of the IT committee. And I see real problems down the road with a computer, something that's going down the road, 2,000 pounds going down the road, controlled by a computer, and it fails. Because they do. They do fail. We all know that. We all have failures in our computers, and we're on the phone to IBM and to Microsoft saying, what's going on? And they've been doing this for a long time. So it does concern me that right now we're in beta testing, of course, and I don't know how long beta testing is going on and how many failures we'll have along the way, but I know that even once we get up and running, there will be failures.
Thank you very much, Senator Riley. Yes. Overall, we do know no system can be perfect, and there will be failures. However, when you consider the fact that we are paying a price of significant price in terms of lost lives on our roads today, and that over 94% of those lost lives are the result of human error, we know and believe that we can build these systems to perform significantly better than human drivers. And so the answer is, yes, we may have incidents and crashes, but we should have them at a much, much lower rate than we're experiencing today, with a much more fallible person behind the wheel than the types of systems that we can deploy.
Sam, I hear you. I'm running out of time unless there are
okay.
other questions.
Good answer. Thank you.
I'm trying to get through a couple more of these. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Travis? Give us kind of quick the department's take on all of this.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Travis Brower. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm here before you because I oversee ODOT's Office of Innovation, which tackles emerging trends in technology. We recognize that automated vehicles are coming, and so over the last year or so, we have been taking steps to start engaging in the policy process related to them. Because of our role as the facilitator of a safe and efficient transportation system, we recognize that we need to play a significant role in this. To that end, we hired an automated and connected vehicle policy advisor and have also stood up a connected and automated vehicle steering team that is brings together folks from our DMV, our motor carrier, our Office of Safety, our folks who work on traffic signals, as well as the Oregon State Police to start working through some of these policy issues. Senator Beyer, I think you made a crucial distinction a few minutes ago between testing and deployment. Testing is going to involve a fairly small number of vehicles on the road that will have experienced test drivers behind the wheel. And deployment, on the other hand, could literally be thousands of vehicles, and we're talking about vehicles that may not have brakes or steering wheels. So as you can imagine, the policy framework that should be put in place for testing versus deployment should probably be a little bit different. With testing, it is reasonable to have a fairly light touch from a regulatory perspective because the safety risk is just not as significant. With deployment, on the other hand, it would be prudent to have a more rigorous regulatory framework in place as we're starting to permit thousands of vehicles to come onto Oregon's roads. So currently, ODOT has no statutory authority to regulate the testing of automated vehicles, and state law does not really preclude testing of automated vehicles so long as there is a driver behind the wheel. As a result, you know, I would tell you that the lack of action by the legislature will not actually prevent testing on Oregon's roads. We have been working with a number of firms that have voluntarily come to ODOT and indicated they want to test on our roads. However, they have there is no requirement that these firms come to ODOT and work with us on the testing regime they put in place, nor do we have any authority to send them back to the drawing board if we are have any concerns about what their test may do from a safety perspective. So we believe it is important to create a policy framework for automated vehicles that would roll out in phases, starting with testing. This framework would have the dual goals of protecting the safety of the traveling public while also seeking to support the development of automated vehicles because of those potential significant benefits for both safety and mobility, particularly for seniors and other folks who can't drive. So for this testing phase, we see a number of elements that might be very prudent to put in place. So for one thing, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, has put out guidance on automated vehicles, and they recommend that each state designate a lead agency. We believe that this would be prudent for the state to do and that ODOT would be the logical agency because we already bring together safety and DMV and motor carrier and all of the other major elements. So we believe that would be helpful to designate ODOT as the lead agency. The second is NHTSA also recommends that each state would stand up an automated safety technology committee across state and local government. So that would include both those who we already have within ODOT coordinating as well as law enforcement and local governments, folks potentially from the insurance sector within state government, as well as, say, the Department of Justice and the governor's office. This group could coordinate statewide implementation and also tackle some of these policy issues and perhaps oversee also a pilot program for AV testing, because we believe it would be important to have a framework in place for actually a statutory framework for automated vehicle testing. Right now, as I mentioned, we're working with folks on a voluntary basis, but there would be some benefit to having a more defined framework in place that would allow us to require certain information from companies. For example, we'd want to know what sort of technologies they're testing, weather conditions, road conditions under which they plan to test to ensure that they're doing so in a safe manner, proof of insurance, confirmation that they meet the federal motor vehicle safety standards, as well as fallback plans for when, in a testing mode, a human driver is going to have to take back control of the vehicle. So we recognize that automated vehicles are coming regardless of what ODOT or legislators are going to do, and that we need to put a statutory framework for AV deployment in place to keep Oregonians safe and to make sure our transportation system moves efficiently. Given the current pace of technological development, we see that there is the potential and likelihood that automated vehicles may be deployed on Oregon's roads within a few years. So if the legislature were to wait until the 2019 legislative session, it may be a little bit on the late side of things. You may start seeing vehicles coming onto the roads within that period. So we would hope that the work that we could do within ODOT of being the lead agency and convening stakeholders and others could help inform what might need to be put in place.
So Travis, let me stop you. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the testing and the stuff that you talked about, you have the authority to do that now. I mean, I understand it's voluntary, but you have the authority to set a framework study process. What you don't have the authority to do is to compel companies who wish to do this with the driver behind the wheel to participate. I guess the question would be, and I know you're not going to tell me you support or oppose this because you don't do that without the governor's approval. But I guess the question is, does the department feel they need some statutory authority? And if so, are you going to bring us an amendment?
Mm-hmm. Senator Beyer, members of the committee, as a state agency, we believe it is always best for us to be operating within statutory frameworks that are created by the legislature. So while we can certainly continue in this voluntary testing environment, it would be easier for ODOT to have put in place some direction from the legislature to ensure that we are operating in the correct way based on your feedback.
Well, our feedback is going to be tell us what you need and go get an amendment if you want one. We're not going to move this one today. Okay.
Senator Beyer, we can
other questions? I got a lot of stuff going on here.
I got a brief one. I know DMV is a subdivision of ODOT, mm-hmm. but Why wouldn't it be under more restrictive under DMV?
DMV is part of ODOT.
Yeah, Senator Rod,
that's
Senator
what
Beyer,
I just said.
In other states such as California, it is directly the DMV that has had that role. That's because in many other states, DMV is a separate agency. We believe that ODOT brings all of those elements together under one banner, and so it would be important to have that within the department.
Yeah. Seems like you've got some tests that are going on now with freight trucks. Mm-hmm. On 84. So, I mean, you clearly, apparently have the, feel like you have some authority to do it, so.
Yeah, Senator Beyer, we've been working with a number of companies, one of which is testing truck platooning, which is really a connected vehicle application mm-hmm. rather than necessarily an automated vehicle application. And they have been working very closely with us on the framework and providing information on a voluntary basis. And so we will continue to work with them as they look to roll it out.
Unless there are other questions, I've got a list of people and I got a bill that I got to get to. So what I would ask, Travis, is if you, it sounds like you're saying you need something, I would ask that we're not going to move this today. If you would like to work with Patrick and get an amendment, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, we can certainly do that.
Thank you very much. Let's see now. Mr. Powell and Eric Jones. And if you can hold your comments to 2 or 3 minutes, that'd be great.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm in opposition to House Bill 3119. My full comments are available on OLIS, so in mm-hmm. the interest of time, I will quickly summarize, let's see, 2 or 3 points. First of all, automated vehicle technologies have the potential to significantly impact how insurance provides or protects individuals and businesses from financial loss. Second, the property and casualty insurance industry is a critical stakeholder in this conversation, and I think it's, as I'll point out, it's a very big conversation with a lot of potential issues regarding the deployment of automated technologies because of the need to address issues including coverage and liability, as well as the impact on the general public. So, to the bill, first of all, I'd like to raise concerns on Section 6, which involved data collection and access. I kind of think of, when I say data collection, like the black box we all know about when an airplane crashes. You go to the black box to get the data to find out what happens. This kind of data is going to be very important that insurers are able to have access to it to properly underwrite and discover what the risks are in this technology, and two, determine what happens in the case of a collision and assess liability and be able to make claim determinations. And then finally, from the general public's perspective, this data access is important in determining the safety and reliability of the technology, because without that access, you really don't know. State Farm would support a lockdown on this kind of data in the event of a collision, up to 30 or about 30 seconds prior to the collision to 5 seconds after the collision or until the vehicle comes to a complete stop, with technology that would not allow that information to be changed. The reason for this is so that clearly if there is litigation that the litigants can access the evidence and that the evidence doesn't get spoiled and ensure no data is lost. Second of all, I will move on to the second point, which is Section 9, the manufacturer liability exemption. We oppose the bill's attempts to exclude manufacturers from liability if the automated vehicle or driving system is modified. The manufacturers and tech companies are currently developing cybersecurity standards with the goal of creating a self-certification process. Simultaneously, the National Highway Safety Traffic Safety Administration is still in the early stages of developing cybersecurity standards. This is important because the language that you see in the bill today
would allow a manufacturer to escape liability if a car was hacked and an accident occurred, and that liability would then fall onto the owner of the car who wasn't in an automated situation, even driving the car. So without further clarification of what constitutes a modification and who ultimately would be responsible in such a situation, this section is likely to limit the remedies that would be available to crash victims. So in summary, a lot of issues here. The defense bar and the plaintiff's bar are united, which should tell you there's some we can't even agree to disagree. So there are a lot of issues there.
Sounds like the insurance companies have got a lot of work to do in the next couple of years because I think it's coming.
Chair Beyer and members.
Any questions of John? Please.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak. My name is Eric Jones, and I am a partner in the regulatory group at Venable LLP, and I'm based in Washington, D.C. And in that role, I serve as counsel to the Self-Driving Coalition for Safer Streets. And we've submitted written testimony, and I understand the issues with time, so I'll provide the highlights. I'd like to provide a little background on what the coalition is, what we're trying to achieve, and our perspectives on efforts at the state level on autonomous vehicles. So the coalition was created in April of 2016. It was formed by Ford, Google, Volvo, Uber, and Lyft. And these companies came together, and they're from diverse backgrounds. They come from their transportation network companies. We have technology companies, and we have automobile manufacturers. And I should mention, too, we've also brought on some non-profit partners recently as well who are focused on this issue, including Mothers Against Drunk Driving, because they see the safety benefits as well. But the companies all came together because they believe that there is a great potential for safety if for the deployment of fully autonomous vehicles. And they are working to ensure that this deployment happens and the testing happens in as swift manner as possible, but also in as safe as manner as possible. And given that perspective, the coalition is very supportive of state efforts on autonomous vehicles and believes that states will play an important role. We've been discussing some of the statements that have been made at the federal level about the role of the states. States have always played a role with highway safety, and we believe that the states continue to play that role. At the same time, the coalition does have concerns when state legislation could end up needlessly slowing down and impacting both testing and development of self-driving vehicles. And we see a number of issues in this legislation that would slow down dramatically self-driving, the testing and deployment of self-driving vehicles in the state of Oregon. And other states have taken a different approach and have taken an approach to more encourage the deployment of the cars. And so we would see, if this bill was enacted, we would see Oregon fall behind other states. And so my written testimony includes specifics on what our concerns are, but I know we're pressed for time, so I won't go into detail on all those, but I'm happy to answer any questions about them. But I will say, too, that to make clear, the coalition is very supportive of Oregon's interest in autonomous vehicles and look forward to working with all of you moving forward.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Let's see here. Quinn Webb and Mark McPherson.
Chair Beyer and committee members, thank you for hearing us. My name is Mark McPherson. I work for Teamsters Joint Council 37 in Portland, Oregon. We represent 22,000 members and 9 local unions in the state of Oregon. I'd like to say that the Teamsters recognize that self-driving technology is coming. It's probably going to be here someday. And the concerns I express are concerns really that we need to be very, very careful entering into this new world. It should be entered into with safe and practical integration to our society. We need to be sure that all our ducks in a row here and that all of the safety provisions are in place. I heard Mr. Leachy say something about human beings are not safe drivers. I will tell you, the Teamsters will take issue with that to some extent.
Okay? Imagine.
And really, but we do. We are on the road all the time. We are the drivers in this country. And I hope you'll listen to our ideas and our concerns. Primarily, our concerns And obviously everyone's going to say it's jobs. It is jobs. We are concerned with potential commercial application of driverless technology and the impact it could have on our whole state in terms of 22,000 potential Teamsters whose jobs could be impacted. These are living wage jobs, good paying jobs with health and welfare benefits and good pensions. And that's just Teamster jobs, okay, because there's a lot of truck drivers out there who are in other unions or who are non-union as well. But let me address our primary concerns, our safety. Safety, and I'll break it into two areas. One is, I assume that these systems for self-driving vehicles are electronically based, and so that means that if you had, I question what would happen if you have a short circuit, if you run out of energy or electricity for any reason, a short circuit, a blown fuse, whatever it may be. As well as equipment malfunction, whether you have a blown tire, whatever it may be, a wheel bearing goes out, how do these self-driving vehicles handle those sorts of problems? And I think that we all, in a human nature, view self-driving technology through our own personal lens of experience. And our own personal lens of experience is driving our own personal vehicles. And I mean, I say, I've driven the same car for 7 years. I've hardly had to do any maintenance to it at all. God bless me, but I have. I've had very, very little problems with my vehicle ever. But when you're talking about autonomous vehicles, all of a sudden there's not a human in there. This vehicle could drive 24 hours a day. Your vehicles, what do you drive? Maybe 12, 15,000 miles a day. A commercial vehicle now, truck drivers, they put on their trucks maybe 100,000 miles a year, as opposed to 12,000. If you have an autonomous vehicle that can drive 24 hours a day, it can be on the road all the time other than fueling and when it gets serviced, the wear and tear on that vehicle, on the electrical system, on the mechanical components, is really dramatic. And we have to think about those sorts of things. I would question also, I'm trying to cut really short here my notes, but from safety standpoint, I question the ability of a vehicle to drive autonomously in, say, a snowstorm. Can those sensors tell where the road ends and the sidewalk begins? Can it identify things? I've driven in horrendous torrential downpours of rain where it is really hard to determine what is what on the road. And I question whether the sensors in these vehicles are capable of doing that. And I think this is technology that's coming. And I think it's going to get refined and it's going to be fine. But my only caution here is I don't support the legislation because I think there needs to be more questions answered, more research done. And I hate to put Oregonians' lives at risk as a test crash dummy.
Thank you. Sir.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for hearing me. My name is Quinn Webb. I'm a Teamsters business rep out of Teamsters Local 324 here in Salem, Oregon. I represent nothing but commercial drivers and as well from Class A all the way down to regular driver's license. I'm concerned with the technology out there, having some of the same concerns that Mark has. But obviously my bigger concern is, and there's no debating it, I don't want to see good jobs go away. You know, I represent a lot of good drivers as far as safety goes, and this gentleman bringing up safety standards. I drove 2 million miles on the roads of Oregon alone, just in Oregon, and never had an incident. Never had a ticket, never had an accident, and I have many, many, many drivers like that. In the 10 years that I've been representing drivers out of Teamsters Local 324, I've had one fatality accident. It was in adverse weather conditions, and the same things Mr. McPherson brought up about these computer-driven vehicles being on the roads. The last thing I want to see is a computer making decisions that control something that could be 105,000 pounds. I would ask you not to let this go through at this time. Let technology get there, and at some point down the road, it's going to happen. I get it. You get it. If you have any questions, thank you for your time.
Questions? Good points.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
All right, Elizabeth Edwards and Art Towers.
Tell me, I got another committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elizabeth Edwards with the City of Portland. You have a letter from Mayor Wheeler and Transportation Commissioner Dan Salzman on OLIS, so I'll keep my comments brief. The City of Portland is opposed to the bill in its current form because it will preempt local authority and prematurely authorizes the widespread use of autonomous vehicles. But that said, the city is very excited about the opportunities that autonomous vehicles present, and we are actively partnering with private and university sectors in order to develop best practices for testing and piloting autonomous, electric, and shared vehicles within the city. And the reason why we're cautious and also very intrigued and pushing forward is that if done correctly, autonomous vehicles mean you're reducing crashes, you're closing gaps in the first and last mile of transit, you're reducing emissions, you're hitting a lot of big goals that our city planners prioritize. However, if it's not done correctly, autonomous vehicles could lead to more congestion, more vehicle miles traveled, and more emissions. So right now we're on the cusp, and it's an exciting time. And we're committed to working with both public and private stakeholders to help craft policies that bring us forward and help to deploy this technology. So I guess today we respectfully request that a work group come together and we'll work with ODOT and others so that we can collaboratively craft policies to advance shared economic, environmental, safety, and equity goals. So with that, I'll leave the rest of it to the letter.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trail Lawyers Association. And while we do oppose the legislation in its current form, we are intrigued and excited about the potential for this technology. Our members, I think, unlike any of the other people who've testified today, our members see the human impact of the carnage on the roads every day. And we want that carnage to stop. We see what this does to families, and we want it to stop. But we are concerned that that this bill doesn't put safety and accountability first, and we think that those are very important steps. We don't want to pick winners and losers. We don't want to stifle innovation, but we do want to make sure that when people get hurt, that those who are accountable are held accountable. And I think that this bill leaves a lot of gaps there. We're concerned about, in the specifics, we're concerned about the access to the crash data. We're concerned about the language and having to do with surety bonds and self-insurance not being consistent with motor vehicle insurance law now. We're concerned about the manufacturer ducking all liability if their system is hacked, you know, because it could be easily hacked. Or should they be off the hook if it can be hacked with a $9.95 kit? I'll wrap it up by saying that we're worried. You know, we do think that this is coming. We do want it to be safe. We do want Oregon to be a leader, although we are, you know, share the concern about job loss. But you know, really, you have a tremendous responsibility here and a tremendous opportunity. We want to be constructive. We want to, you know, help make this safe, because in the past, it's been a problem. In the past, we've had safety advances where the safety, where the new product comes in, be it seat belts or tires or airbags or whatever, there's a bunch of deaths, there's a bunch of injuries, and then there's a bunch of litigation. And then the second product comes in, and it's the safe one. Can we do anything, and I think we have the power collectively, to shorten that time period, to reduce the injuries and death, and get to a safer product faster? So thank you for your time. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Art.
Thank you.
Any questions? That's it. That's what I got. Thank you very much. We're obviously not going to be working on this bill today, so I'm going to close the public hearing, and I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 982, and I apologize. This is running late. We've got a few people from out of area. Let me see. Who do I want to start with?
You want to do it? Start.
Oh, sure, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 982 regulates the business relationship between equipment suppliers and equipment dealers. I'll leave it at that. We have a Dash 1 amendment that was provided by Senator Girard that makes some modifications to several sections of the bill. We'll probably have to dispense on that until we have Senator Girard to explain the amendment at a later date, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so I apologize for running a little late. I want to give you a chance, and if you do have your testimony on the file, I'll just summarize it, please.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Eric Wareham. I'm Director of Government Affairs for the Western Equipment Dealers Association. We're a North American association that represents over 62 dealer locations in Oregon. That's over $500 million in annual revenue and 850 employees in the state. Since this is a work hearing and you do have my testimony, I think as we've spoken about, we're here today and we have a member with us that will testify more specifically, but I think that we'd like to work together with the manufacturers at this point to reach a compromise. We're a consensus-driven organization. We've handed John Deere and Case IH and other manufacturers this legislation, put that in their hand over 6 months ago. And I think that the opportunity is now before us to come together and reach an agreement and come to you with more of a consensus-driven bill. So we respectfully request that we have a work study group, and with that, I'll turn it over to one of our members.
Thank you. Sir.
Good afternoon. Eric Skritsky with Lynn Benton Tractor. Two locations, one in Silverton, headquarters down in Tangent. We've been in business for about 25 years, family-owned operation. A lot of the Senate bills that are in place today are a good foundation. We just need to get them updated. A lot of these same Senate bills are the same as when we started the dealership from the grassroots and came up 25 years ago. What, as we all know, business has changed over 25 years. We need more transparency, more bargaining power with our vendors, and just updating exactly what those statutes are. So our relationships with the manufacturers is what allows Lynn Benton Tractor to provide quality goods and services to our customers. We ask for your support in Senate Bill 982.
Okay, thank you. Now, let me see if I can help out here a little bit. My understanding is that there's been an agreement to do a work group on this, and Senator Thompson has stated his willingness to work with a work group. Does that work for everybody?
It does. Yep. Well, it works for us. Yep. I won't speak for the other members here.
Yes. Does that work? Given that there's a work group, do you feel a need to testify? You came a long ways. Do you want to testify? Please. We're good? All right.
I think you might want to come over now.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Chair Beyer, and thank you, Senator Thompson.
Yeah. Paul? Thank you.
I would just point, Paul Cosgrove, representing John Deere, there is a lot of testimony in OLIS from both John Deere, association, and some other manufacturers, and I just refer that to you. As if there's a work group and another product comes back, I assume we'll have a chance to comment at that time.
I'm sensing a willingness to work something out here. I don't need to spend a lot of time on it if that's accurate. But I want to give you the chance. You came a long way to testify if you feel a need.
Mr. Chairman, that's fine.
You cool?
We're certainly willing to work with the Western Equipment Dealer Association, as I know the other manufacturers are. All right. So I appreciate that.
All righty. Jenny's not here. Is there anybody who feels the need to testify on this? We'll carry it over. Don't see any, so we're going to close on Senate Bill 986. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 867.
Here, I'll have these down, Mr. Chair. If I can give you a quick rundown, Mr. Chair.
Please.
So this measure, we heard it on the 27th. We heard it on Monday. It has subsequent referral to Senate General Government and Accountability and a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. So getting it to the General Government Accountability Committee gives them an opportunity, should they choose to schedule it. The measure has a Dash 1 amendment, which we had before us on Monday. It has a fiscal statement issued and no revenue impact. So the paperwork is all in hand, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thompson?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 867.
Senator Thompson has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 867. Is any discussion? Is there any opposition? Those are adopted. Senator?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 867 with the Dash 1 amendment to...
To
the floor with a due pass and a subsequent referral to general government accountability, then to Ways and Means.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 867 as amended by the Dash 1 with the due pass recommendation, to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and a subsequent referral to the Committee on General Government and Accountability, and then subsequently to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay.
Discussion. Wonderful. Opposition, none. It is done.
Mr. Chair, I oppose.
You oppose?
Yeah.
Well, all right. One opposition, Senator Thompson is opposed. Senator Girard is absent. And with that, we are done. Was there something here, Rob? You're usually not in front of our committee.
No, it's just 867, and okay. So, yeah, that's what I'm
doing. So now he's going to come see me.
By my client staff, so.
All righty. We are adjourned.
Staff, so.
All righty.